There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This episode contains distressing themes and descriptions of sexual violence. This podcast is intended for a mature audience. Listener caution is advised. The autumn air was chilly even though it was warm for an afternoon in October. Brown leaves rustled under the feet of children and their dog Pip as they walked towards the river. Thomas Brown held Pip's lead tightly while his 5-year-old son and 3-year-old daughter happily led the way on the familiar route. Something caught Thomas's attention at the bottom of a set of stone stairs known to locals as the ABC Steps. 26 stone platforms jutted out from the steeply sloping hill towards the canal towpath, a stone for each letter of the alphabet. A young girl was curled up at the bottom of the stairs, her legs folded beneath her as if she were crying. Thomas wondered if she was upset or had fallen, but the reality was far worse.
He wrote many documents. He wrote poems. He wrote songs. He drew pictures. In many ways, he was his own worst enemy, because that layer upon layer upon layer of what I would describe as circumstantial evidence really hit home to me that this individual, this dangerous sexual homicidal predator, was responsible for Elsie's death.
Welcome to Season 9, Episode 7 of They Walk Among Us, a podcast dedicated to UK true crime. In 1965, Wakefield had a population of around 60,000 people. The majority of residents in the fast-growing city on the banks of the River Calder were the young families of miners or railway workers. It was roughly 4:15 p.m. on Saturday, October 9th, when Thomas Brown walked down the ABC steps to check on the young girl. He asked her if she was okay, but her face was covered by brown hair and the red anorak she was wearing. Feeling panicked, Thomas shouted up to his children to stay put. He put his hands beneath the girl's armpits to try and lift her off the cold floor. It was then that he saw blood on her head and face, and a tear in the back of her coat. Thomas called out for help, and it did not take long for others who were walking along the towpath to come to his aid. Harold Doran lived nearby and went to Thornsmoor Road to wait for an ambulance. John Blackburn, a master at Snapethorpe School, had been at a sailing club organised by city schools to teach local Girl Guide Rangers boating skills. He recognised the young girl as one of the students who had been assisting at the club that afternoon, 14-year-old Elsie Frost. Elsie lived on Manor Hague Road with her parents Arthur and Edith and her 6-year-old brother Colin. She attended Wakefield City Girls High School and was known to be bubbly, friendly and helpful, with a keen interest in religion and a love of the sound of music. Her older sister Anne had moved out of the family home and was living with her young son Martin. On the morning of Saturday, October 9th, Elsie had gone to the city centre at her mother's request to do some errands. Wakefield was steadily expanding, and a new indoor market had been opened just a year prior. Elsie stopped off at her sister's that afternoon wearing a yellow cardigan, a patterned skirt, a red anorak, and a new pair of leather shoes she had promised to keep clean when her mother saw her slip over earlier that morning. Elsie had lunch with Anne and her nephew before heading off to help out at the sailing club. The club meeting was held at Horbury Lagoon, a water-filled quarry excavated between World War I and World War II. The scenic route around the 5-acre lagoon was bisected by the newly built M1 motorway. On one side there were the railway tracks, and on the other there was the River Calder. Elsie arrived at the lagoon at around 2 p.m, and for 2 hours she taught other young girls how to build and sail dinghies. After mooring the boats and dismantling the makeshift dinghies, Elsie said goodbye to the schoolmasters and walked towards the path leading to the railway embankment. She had asked her father Norman to collect her, but he was exhausted after a night's work on the railways, so she began walking the 2-mile journey back home to Manor Hague Road in Lupsid, Wakefield, alone. It's believed that Elsie turned back onto the towpath along the river's edge, where it forked off into the Calder and Hebble navigation. The ground along the railway embankment was muddy, so she would have been concerned that the route would ruin her new shoes. A group of boys cycled past her around a quarter of a mile from the lagoon. Less than 10 minutes later, Elsie Frost was found dead just outside of a darkened railway tunnel. After Elsie's heartbroken parents were notified, her remains were examined by Dr. Donald Hainsworth, a professor of forensic medicine at Leeds University. Dr. Hainsworth found that the teenager had been a victim of a brutal attack. She had sustained 5 stab wounds to her back, head, and hand. She had been stabbed twice in the back. One wound was curved, indicating that the knife had been twisted, and the second injury was to the upper left of her back. It was 4.5 centimetres deep and perforated her left lung and her heart. 2 stab wounds had been inflicted to Elsie's head. One was located behind her right ear and penetrated her skull. The second head wound was more shallow than the other, and Dr. Hainsworth concluded that Elsie had held up her hand to protect herself, but the knife went through her hand and into her head. The doctor believed that Elsie had been attacked from behind, and it would have taken a substantial amount of force to inflict the injuries. Blood evidence inside the 30-foot tunnel leading to the ABC steps where Elsie was found was consistent with the theory that she had been attacked as soon as she walked into the brick archway, and her attacker pursued her as she tried to get away. According to the forensic expert, Elsie had been stabbed in the back first and then in the head several seconds before she succumbed to her injuries. Bruising on her body likely resulted from her falling onto the steps. Dr. Hainsworth said that the murder weapon was likely a knife with a blade measuring at least 4 inches long and 3/4 inches wide, with one sharpened edge that tapered to a point. What was then the West Riding Constabulary was one of the smallest police forces in England at the time, with around 112 officers working in the area. Over 50 of those officers were tasked with searching the area near the ABC steps, the railway tunnel, the grassy embankment, and the towpath. Tracker dogs were led through the overgrown patches of land between the waterways as specialist divers trudged through drained parts of the canal. 2 days after the discovery of Elsie's body, an inquest was opened and adjourned by Wakefield Deputy Coroner Philip Gill. He said, "I can only hope that anyone who was in the vicinity when this happened will come forward and help if it is at all possible, whether they think their information will be of assistance or not. It is most important that anyone who can give information will do so." Chief Constable Clifford Jarrett of the West Riding Constabulary led the investigation, assisted by Superintendent Herbert Guyver, who was brought in from Scotland Yard. They appealed to anyone who was near the scene at the sailing club or on Wakefield Municipal Golf Course between 3 to 5pm on October 9th. In an effort to recover the murder weapon, specialists in finding explosive devices were brought to the area with mine detectors. The bare winding pathways between the tall grass along the canal were filled with police constables in their black capes, directed by senior investigating officers. House-to-house inquiries were conducted in the neighbouring estates, and anyone who was in the vicinity on the day of the murder was asked to attend a meeting at a nearby school. Their approximate locations on the day in question were pinpointed on a composite aerial map of the area between the ABC steps and Denby Dale Road. A reconstruction was then planned in the hopes that people would notice if someone they had seen was missing. The murder weapon was not found, but a 12-inch leather knife sheath was recovered close to the scene. On October 22nd, following the reconstruction, the West Riding Constabulary released an identikit image of a man they wished to speak with. The witness had come forward to say that he had seen an individual in his 20s on the afternoon Elsie was killed. The man was described as being around 5 feet 7 inches tall with dark brown or black hair swept back at the sides, but bushy on top with curls that fell over his forehead. He had thick eyebrows that almost met in the middle and spoke with a Yorkshire accent. The police believed he was a local, wearing a black donkey jacket with leather shoulders, a woolen jumper and dark blue jeans. Inquiries continued throughout the winter months, with over 10,000 people questioned. It was then time for the inquest. Proceedings were opened on January 4, 1966 at the Town Hall in Wakefield. Coroner Philip Gill described Elsie's death as a most brutal, vicious and wicked attack, completely without motive. One of the first witnesses was John Blackburn, the Snapethorpe schoolmaster who had organised the sailing club where Elsie had spent the afternoon before she was found dead. Blackburn said that soon after Elsie left at 4pm, he saw a man aged around 20 with black hair and a dark jacket. Blackburn added, "He passed some pleasantries about the weather, and I replied and he went off." John Blackburn did not see the man at the reconstruction, though he wasn't sure he would recognise him if he saw him again. David Hopwood told the coroner's jury that he had parked his car at Black Ash near the towpath, around 45 minutes before the murder was estimated to have taken place. Hopwood had seen a man stooping forward as he walked along the towpath with his hands in his pockets, but Hopwood did not recognise him. A number of witnesses also recalled seeing a man with a camera on the railway embankment. Harry Sidgrove was driving a diesel passenger train past the scene just before 4 p.m. and saw the man with the camera. Sidgrove told the inquest, "He was looking towards me. He lifted his camera as though to take a photograph. But as I got nearer, he must have changed his mind because he let the camera drop onto a strap that was around his neck." 19-year-old John Wilson had been in the area taking photographs of trains. However, he claimed to have arrived at the same time as the ambulance around 4:30 p.m. In his testimony, he said that he had seen Harold Doran get into the ambulance on Thornsmoor Road and guide it to the scene. Many people had been in the area around the time of the murder, but no one had seen Elsie being attacked or someone fleeing the scene. Detective Inspector Peter Gilrain from the West Riding Constabulary said that anyone in the area would have been visible from the towpath unless they walked on the railway embankment. Thousands of people had been questioned, but the police had not made any progress towards identifying a suspect. Detective Inspector Gilrain went on to say, "There was no apparent motive for the attack. No one has been traced who had the slightest animosity towards the girl." A number of men had yet to be identified, but one name came up repeatedly during the evidence at the inquest: Ian Spencer. Harold Doran, the man who had flagged down the ambulance on Saturday, October 9th, told the inquest that he had seen Spencer walking away from the area of the ABC steps at around 3:30 p.m. This supported Ian Spencer's own account. He said he had walked down Thornsmoor Road to the river and was back around 3:30 p.m. He recalled arriving home at that time and being greeted by his wife and mother-in-law. According to Ian Spencer, he only heard about the murder the following morning when his mother-in-law informed him what had happened. Spencer stated, "She mentioned the girl's name, but I did not know the girl by name. When she said she had been stabbed, I immediately thought of my knife. The actual remark, I believe, was it would be just my luck to have lost my knife." The coroner asked why he would make that remark, and Spencer replied, "I had been having a long run of bad luck in my family and myself." Ian Spencer revealed that he later found the knife in a pocket of his overalls and admitted that he had a number of knives in his home, including some throwing knives and a folding knife he had brought back from his time serving in Egypt. The police had searched the property where Spencer lived and found a Gurkha knife with a large curved blade, but nothing consistent with the injuries Elsie Frost received. Two teenage boys, Gerald Burton and Richard Jackson, had been riding their bikes to the sailing club on the opposite side of the River Calder. Gerald said he saw a man he knew as Ian Spencer cycling towards the ABC steps shortly before 4 p.m. The teenager recognised his dark clothes and the old bike with sit-up type handlebars Spencer was riding. According to Gerald Burton, Ian Spencer met him the next day and said he was going to the lagoon to see if he could help. When they crossed paths again on Monday, October 11th, Gerald told Spencer that he had seen him on the day of the murder, but Spencer argued that Gerald must have been mistaken as he was home by 3:30 p.m. Gerald testified, "We told him that we definitely saw him at 5 to 4. He said he had glanced at the clock when he got home and it was 3:30 by that clock." Philip Barstow had also gone to the scene that day after Elsie was killed to offer his assistance. He saw Ian Spencer, who suggested they look along the railway line, where a locked hut with a deep well was located. Ivy Taylor testified that she had just switched on her television at 4 p.m. on October 9th to watch wrestling, when she saw a man wearing dark overalls and Wellington boots pass her house in the direction of the ABC steps. She often saw him on weekends and Wednesday afternoons with a boat, and her son recognized him as Ian Spencer. Two other women also testified that they saw him in the area and described what he had been wearing. On the fourth day of the inquest, Ian Spencer was called back from the witness waiting room and informed that his evidence did not match that of the other witnesses. Coroner Philip Gill told him, "I want you to realise the seriousness and importance of the oath you have just taken. While you were not here this morning, evidence was given by a number of people, which gives rise to a number of discrepancies in the evidence you have given." Ian Spencer stuck to his account and insisted he had been home with his wife from 3:30 p.m. During his summation, the coroner reviewed the descriptions of men who had not been identified during the investigation. This included the man who had been described in reports as wearing a dark-coloured donkey jacket, seen leaning on the ABC steps a few minutes before Elsie was believed to have been attacked. The coroner said, "This person is one of the people who have not been specifically identified with any of the others in the vicinity at the time. You may think the description of this person is particularly important." Shortly after the man was seen, the young boys who had passed Elsie on their bike separated at the ABC steps, and two of them stood on the grassy verge at the top of the steps talking for a few minutes. Coroner Philip Gill remarked, "You may come to the conclusion that Elsie Frost may have been murdered almost while these two boys were talking only a short distance from the steps." There was then the matter of inconsistencies in evidence given by witnesses about the timing of their movements. John Wilson admitted to being in the area with a camera, but said he had arrived at the same time as the ambulance, yet he had recalled seeing Harold Doran getting into the emergency vehicle. The coroner said, "If Mr. Wilson had been on the bridge before the ambulance came on the scene, how on earth would he have described the events in Thornsmoor Road? You may think it is clear from that he must have been somewhere in the vicinity of Thornsmoor Road to enable him to describe what happened." Coroner Philip Gill asked the jury to consider if there was evidence to indicate who was responsible for Elsie Frost's death. "You may think that if this girl was murdered, and it is perfectly clear from the evidence that she was, it is a most dreadful murder, a most dastardly crime, and something which requires the utmost investigation and inquiry. If for no other reason than because until the person responsible is detected, he or she is at large and the same thing may happen again." Referring to the testimony of Ivy Taylor, who claimed to have seen Ian Spencer walking towards the ABC steps at 4 p.m, the coroner remarked, "Look at her evidence very carefully. Because if she is right, then the evidence Mr. Spencer gave is wrong. Is she referring to this particular day? Is she referring to this man? Or is she referring to some other man? Mr. Spencer flatly denied he was there at the time, and it is for you to say which of those two people you think is telling the truth. Is Mrs. Taylor thinking of some other occasion? Or is she remembering what happened on this particular day?" The coroner highlighted the evidence of four people who said that Ian Spencer went down to the ABC steps at around 4 p.m. Coroner Philip Gill added, "The next person who comes along is the girl who is murdered. You may think the crucial time was between 4:05 p.m. and 4:10 p.m. He could have gotten to the scene and by immense stroke of good luck avoided seeing any of the people who could have seen him in the locality. Could it be that he was waiting on the other side of the arch to see this girl come along, and in the short time he was there, come out of the bushes in which he was hiding to have made this attack, and retracted back to the bushes from where he had come. Could it be then he had to make his escape? He was a person who knew the locality well. He knew what cover there was. Could it be he escaped along the embankment, leaving his bicycle hidden in the bushes, making his way from the scene until he comes back on the towpath? Certainly that seems to be the only escape. Certainly whoever took that route must have had knowledge of the locality. The coroner described Ian Spencer as a man who glorified in knives, but pointed out that he did not have a knife that was consistent with the murder weapon, and Spencer insisted that he was home before the killing took place. Coroner Philip Gill asked the jury, "Who is speaking the truth? Is Mr. Spencer right and all of these witnesses wrong?" It was a question that he was right on every detail and all the other witnesses who gave evidence in contradiction were wrong. You may wonder why that was. Out of all the mass of information, there is only one person's evidence that does not fit in. That is Mr. Spencer's. Elsie Frost's parents were present in the public gallery as the jury was sent out to deliberate. The coroner had told them that if they were able to say with any degree of clarity who had killed Elsie, then it was their duty to say so. After 2 hours, the members of the coroner's jury returned. The foreman announced at the inquest, "It is our unanimous verdict that Elsie Frost was murdered, that her death was due to shock and hemorrhage caused by multiple stab wounds, and it is also our unanimous verdict that there is a prima facie against Ian Bernard Spencer." The coroner Philip Gill recorded a verdict of murder committed by Ian Spencer and asked for him to be brought back in from the witness waiting room. The 33-year-old railway worker was oblivious when he walked into the court that he was to be immediately arrested and committed to Leeds Prison under a coroner's warrant. Until 1977, coroners had the power to imply criminal liability at an inquest. Since the Criminal Law Act 1977 was enacted, coroners are no longer permitted to consider who may be responsible for an unlawful killing. On January 12, 1966, Ian Spencer, who lived on Thorns Way in Wakefield with his wife and young son Lee, was brought before Wakefield Magistrates Court. After being charged with Elsie Frost's murder, Ian Spencer replied, "I have nothing to say." Coroner Philip Gill formally closed the inquest, and Ian Spencer was held on remand while he awaited trial. A report was sent to the Director of Public Prosecutions and a committal hearing was held before the magistrates on February 8, 1966. Prosecutor Kenneth Horn said that Elsie was killed in a 20-minute period before 4:20 p.m. Ian Spencer had told the police he was home by 3:30 p.m., but several witnesses claimed to have seen him around the time of the murder. A flick knife Ian Spencer's wife had found in their home was turned over to the prosecution for forensic testing. Defence barrister Colin Muscroft told the court, "Fresh evidence has come to light found by the defence, and in accordance with the instructions of the accused, who all along has stated his intention to help the police as much as possible and disclose as much evidence as is available to him. That evidence is now produced by the defence." Stuart Kind, a principal scientific officer at the Northeastern Forensic Science Laboratory in Harrogate, had taken samples of blood-stained glass and blood droplets from the ABC steps. He had also examined Elsie's clothing, Ian Spencer's clothing, a bike, knives, and a knife sheath found near the scene. Furthermore, a bloodstain had been identified on the lower right leg of Spencer's trousers. Blood typing showed that it was Group A. Elsie Frost's blood type was Group O, but Ian Spencer's was Group A. The defence argued that there was nothing to link Ian Spencer to the murder and asked the magistrates to accept that discrepancies between witness statements were not the result of lies but simple mistakes. Colin Muscroft highlighted that there was no blood, footprints or motive to implicate Ian Spencer. Quote, "No wonder that in January, months after the crime was committed and after prolonged and detailed inquiries, that Inspector Gilrain was able to say to the coroner's jury that at that moment, there was no person charged or likely to be charged with the offence." Ian Spencer's counsel argued that the prosecution had been stampeded into action by the verdict of the coroner's jury and said, "I cannot resist the comment that that is an archaic institution whose early demise is sought by many. All his movements are things he has never denied, and indeed the only thing the prosecution says is that he has given wrong times. But when one investigates the evidence, it is clear that in that evidence there is a great discrepancy on times as anyone might imagine there would be." After 45 minutes of deliberating a defence motion to dismiss the charges, the magistrates returned on February 15th. Chair Elizabeth Beaumont announced, "We have given careful consideration to the submission and studied all the relevant papers, and we uphold the submission that there is no case to answer, and as far as this court is concerned, the accused is discharged." When she heard Marjorie Spencer burst into tears outside the court, but as her husband had been committed for trial on a coroner's warrant, his application for bail was adjourned, and a trial was set for the following month. It only took 5 minutes for the legal proceedings to end at Leeds Assizes on March 10th. The prosecution offered no evidence, and Mr. Justice Ashworth directed the jury to return a not guilty verdict as there was no case to answer. Ian Spencer was released and met his wife outside the court. When they got back to their home, they were surrounded by relatives and reporters who interviewed them while they sat hand in hand on the sofa. Ian Spencer said he had spent his time in prison completing jigsaw puzzles and making model boats. He had only learned that the prosecution were not pursuing the case minutes before he entered the dock. He said he planned to take a holiday with his family and return to work as a labourer. Marjorie expressed her relief at the verdict and said, "It feels as if a big weight has been lifted from us." Once the verdict of the coroner's jury was returned, it was discovered that Ian Spencer had been the only suspect the police pursued in connection with Elsie Frost's murder. After he was acquitted, the investigation failed to progress, and it took 5 decades for the case to be reviewed.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger. Feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
This episode of They Walk Among Us is brought to you in association with Scentair. Ever entered a seemingly perfect space only to feel like something was missing? That's where Scentair comes in. With over 3 decades of experience, Scentair leads the scent marketing industry, scenting resorts, retail outlets, event spaces and more, partnering with major brands like Westin Hotels and Snap Fitness. Chances are you've already encountered their fragrances firsthand. And now Scentair is offering you a luxury fragrance experience in the comfort of your home. Visit Scentair.com to explore their online store and infuse your spaces with unforgettable scents. Scentair diffusers are sleek and fill your space with vivid fragrance for up to 300 hours. And the Scentair app lets you schedule your fragrance and control your intensity right from your phone. What's more, all of Scentair's more than 60 fragrances are phthalate-free, cruelty-free, safe for families and EcoVadis certified sustainable. Differentiate your space with scent. Try luxury home fragrance trusted by the pros by going to Scentair.com and using promo code AMONGUS for an extra 25% off your first order. That's promo code AMONGUS for an extra 25% off your first order at Scentair.com.
In October 1965, the brutal murder of a teenage schoolgirl was as shocking as it would be today. Her brother Colin was just 6. For years, he couldn't bring himself to visit the spot where his sister died.
To die in a place like this alone, who knows what she was thinking as she was actually dying? You know, was she crying for mum? We lost Elsie in very violent and tragic circumstances, so you've had a complete family become an incomplete family, and it's that that you don't forget.
Elsie's siblings Anne and Colin had contacted a BBC Radio 4 show, IPM, about Elsie's murder. The investigative radio show led to new information being passed to the West Yorkshire Constabulary, which started a review of the case in October 2015 called Operation Plain Lake. The reinvestigation was led by Detective Chief Inspector Elizabeth Belton.
The murder affected a lot of people at the time, and people are still talking about it some 50 years on. So I'm hopeful that somebody will come forward with a vital piece of information.
Several leads that had not been pursued during the original investigation were looked at more thoroughly. A man seen in the area wearing a white lab coat riding a bicycle was asked to come forward. DCI Belton said. The bicycle had a basket at the front, and I'm thinking he could have been a delivery boy. Did he deliver for a butcher's? Did he work in an abattoir and was making his way to or from work? I'd like to identify that person or anyone who can recall seeing that person. There was also speculation that Elsie might have had a boyfriend or someone she was interested in at the time. On the night before she was killed, Elsie had gone to Bound Lane Youth Club with her friend Janice Hurst. Elsie's father had informed investigators that she had worn her best clothes and asked if she could stay later than usual. A friend had also told the police that Elsie had left the sailing club early before to meet someone else. Adding that Elsie had not taken the shortest route home, DCI Belton said. Again, she goes to the boating lake in good clothes and new shoes, which she had only bought that morning. She gets changed at the boating lake to go boating and then puts on the good clothes to make her way home, in effect back home. It makes you think, is she meeting somebody? Has she met somebody special? Elsie's friend Janice usually walked with her to the sailing club on Saturdays, but on Saturday, October 9th, 1965, she had to stay home to help her mother who was unwell. Around the 50th anniversary of Elsie's murder, Janice told a reporter for ITV, "I've always felt guilty I wasn't with her that day. I thought for years if I had been, she would be alive today. I had nightmares about her death for years, and in them I could never get to Elsie. Elsie was lovely, a quiet, pretty girl, shy but just about to bloom. She didn't deserve to die so young or in such violent circumstances." Janice had been best friends with Elsie since junior school and found it hard to believe that she had kept a relationship a secret. "I know the police are saying she might have had a secret boyfriend, but I would be stunned if she had. She never showed any interest in lads when I was with her. Someone is hiding a secret. It might be the killer. It might be the killer's family. Elsie deserves justice, and I hope the new investigation brings closure for her family and for me." Speaking at the bottom of the ABC steps, Elsie's younger brother Colin Frost said coming to the scene of his sister's murder was incredibly hard. "I thought that 50 years would have dissolved that type of emotion. But when I was stood here with my partner and DCI Belton, thank goodness I'd got one on each side. We have more hope now than we have ever had. The answer to Elsie's murder lies in Wakefield. Someone has lived with guilt inside them all their lives. We have accepted the killer may not be alive now, but they may be. There may not be good news at the end of this, but we have got hope that there will be justice. Justice for the family and for the people of Wakefield as well. Like us, they have never forgotten Elsie." On the anniversary of Elsie Frost's murder, a memorial service was held at St. George's Church in Lupsett. Colin and Anne wore yellow ribbons embossed with their sister's photograph. Colin read a story he wrote about Elsie's death called The Knock on the Door. He told mourners that Elsie was like a third mother to him, after his mother Edith and his older sister Anne. Colin said, "Mum 3 was taken away from the little boy but not so he could see her each night, like his mum when she returned from work, not like he could go over and visit her like he could with Mum 2. I would like to tell you that the family lived happily ever after, but we didn't. We couldn't because we missed our daughter, our sister." Anne described how she and Elsie loved playing together, and Elsie enjoyed acting as a doctor or a teacher. She had ambitions of being a nurse when she finished school. Anne added, "Elsie was a lovely little girl. We would chase each other around the house. We were full of beans from waking up until sleeping, and then some more. At 4 p.m. on the day of the anniversary, doves were released in Elsie's memory, and her brother Colin said, "Today's been purely about remembering Elsie. We wanted to celebrate her young life. Timing was crucial because we finished the service in the window we know Elsie died. The doves were just another idea to represent part of Elsie's life. There were 14 doves for the 14 years of her life." Detective Chief Inspector Elizabeth Belton was interviewed and said the investigators were delighted with the response to the new appeal, and dozens of calls had come in with information. In January 2016, the detective revealed that a new suspect had emerged. She went on to say, "A common description of a person of interest which has come from some of the calls has been of a man wearing a brown, potentially duffel-type coat with dark hair who was seen on the canal towpath. He was described as carrying a bag by some witnesses, and was possibly of what was described as a scruffy or student-type appearance. Witnesses described seeing potential suspects in the area of the canal at around the time of the murder, and then in the Denby Dale Road area after 4:45 p.m. and then into the evening." Frustratingly, 2 months later, the investigation was hindered by Detective Chief Inspector Elizabeth Belton's conduct. It emerged that she was being investigated for making racist remarks at the Homicide and Major Inquiry Team Christmas party and had been placed on restricted duties. The detective had also come under investigation 4 years prior following an incident involving two other officers who had an argument while off duty at a gym. At the end of March 2016, she was arrested for misconduct in public office and suspended from duty on suspicion of perverting the course of justice and computer misuse. 3 years later, Elizabeth Belton was sentenced to 2 years in prison for perverting the course of justice by showing a colleague photos of suspects in a break-in before they could be identified in a lineup. Belton was caught after texts she sent were discovered about, quote, "fitting up the suspects." Detective Superintendent Nick Wallen took over the inquiry as senior investigating officer when DCI Belton was suspended. Since a reinvestigation into Elsie Frost's murder was launched in 2015, the West Yorkshire Constabulary had received a significant number of calls and emails from members of the public offering new information. Those leads were followed up, and on September 27, 2016, a new development unfolded when it was announced that a 78-year-old man had been arrested in the Berkshire area on suspicion of murder. The suspect was taken to Thames Valley Police Station before he was bailed the following day. A year and a half would pass, but sadly in March 2018, Detective Superintendent Wallen revealed that it was too late for justice. "We can now formally confirm that Peter Pickering was the man we arrested and interviewed over the last 2 years as part of the renewed investigation into the murder of 14-year-old schoolgirl Elsie Frost in Wakefield in 1965. We strongly suspected that Peter Pickering was responsible for her murder. We had been liaising with the Crown Prosecution Service, and it was our expectation that Pickering would be charged in due course. His unexpected death clearly means that will no longer happen. We have informed all those involved in the case of this development, and we will be liaising with the West Yorkshire coroner as to what proceedings are now necessary in relation to Elsie Frost's death." Peter Pickering had a lengthy criminal history. 5 months after being released from a prison sentence for sexual assault. In the early 70s, Pickering abducted and killed a 14-year-old girl in Wormwell. On July 13, 1972, Shirley Baldy was making her way back to Wormwell High School after spending her lunch break at home. Using his mother's minivan, Pickering kidnapped Shirley and drove her to Barnborough Cliffs in Barnsley. Three men in the area heard screams coming from the van, and when they looked through the back window, they saw the lower half of a female. Assuming it was a courting couple, the men did not intervene. Pickering had tied Shirley's hands behind her back with twine and violently sexually assaulted her before driving to woodland near Clayton Village and strangling her. When he failed to kill Shirley with twine, Pickering used a kitchen knife to stab her to death. The following day, Pickering confessed to the police. "I have committed an irrevocable act," he said. "I have taken the life of an innocent child. Oh God, I have wanted to tell you all night." Pickering led officers to a wooded area in Pilly Hills where they found Shirley's body. Home office psychiatrist Dr. William Heston had testified about Pickering at a pre-trial hearing. "He is above average IQ, articulate and widely read. He is unstable and has shown abnormal aggression since an early age. He does not accept he is responsible for these actions." Counsel for the defence had claimed that Pickering had pleaded for psychiatric help before being released from prison 5 months prior to the killing. Pickering told the police, "My mother is to blame for all this. She has possessed me. My mother would never let me have another woman and always tried to destroy any relationship I had with other females. It was my mother I was killing. They knew I would do this when I left prison." According to Pickering, the feelings he had managed to control over the years boiled over. He added, "When I left prison, I had almost cured myself. I have tried to the best of my ability to act as a normal human being." Pickering had been under constant police surveillance at the time, but officers lost track of him shortly before he abducted Shirley Baldy. One officer said, "Those who knew Peter Pickering knew he would do something awful." Pickering had spent almost 18 years in prison for a number of sexual assaults before he was convicted of killing Shirley. The 34-year-old pleaded guilty to manslaughter by reason of diminished responsibility. His plea was accepted, and he was sentenced to an indeterminate amount of time in a secure facility. Pickering spent the first few years of his sentence at Broadmoor before being transferred to a medium security hospital. In 1984, the Mental Health Act sparked fears that he would be released as the Home Secretary no longer had the power to order him to be detained for life. As his freedom was being considered by a mental health tribunal at Park Lane Hospital the following year, support for his release came from MP Malcolm Thornton, who believed Pickering should be given the chance to prove he was rehabilitated. Thornton said, "We see this picture of a wild bearded man in the papers. That is certainly not the Peter Pickering one sees today. He is respectably dressed. He can converse intelligently and well. He recognises the fact he is in hospital and why. I have met him on three occasions, and he behaved very sensibly. I know a great deal of work has been undertaken with Peter Pickering, and he has made considerable progress during the course of treatment at hospital." Pickering's release was denied, but he was eligible to reapply every 12 months. In 1988, his bid for freedom was backed by Dr. Malcolm McCulloch, a psychiatrist who had testified that Peter Sutcliffe was not fit to plead at his trial, and who had supported the release of child killer James Kay just weeks before he attacked women. Voicing their frustration, Shirley Baldy's devastated parents, Norman and Edna, told the Liverpool Echo, "It's like salt in our wounds. That man should have hung for doing such an evil thing. An indefinite sentence seems a long time, but at the end of the day, he will be let out. And he could come knocking on our door. How can we easily live with that? It is easy for others to condemn hanging, but this has not happened to them. How can we forgive? Shirley was a gem of a girl who had everything going for her." When the Home Office back Pickering's moved to a medium security hospital in Ashworth with supervised day release in 1996, Norman Baldy said, "The memories of the tragedy that befell our little girl on July 13, 1972 have not diminished. It is as painful now as it was at the time. If Mr. Pickering is to be released, we can only hope and pray that he will justify the confidence that the authorities evidently have in him." Pickering remained in psychiatric hospitals until his death in 2018. But as a result of the reinvestigation into Elsie Frost's murder, he was linked to the rape of an 18-year-old 4 weeks before he killed Shirley Baldy. He was convicted of rape and false imprisonment a week before he had a heart attack on March 25, 2018. Two storage units belonging to Pickering had been found that contained letters he had written implying his involvement in not only the rape of the woman in 1972, but Elsie Frost's murder 7 years earlier. When Pickering was officially named as a suspect after his death, Elsie's brother Colin said, "It's difficult to find the words to express how I feel. It's good that the police have put out his name and linked it to Elsie. The hard thing that's going to take some accepting is that he wasn't charged. It's been on the cards for quite a while. It's painful, really, that the charge didn't come through. It would appear that we're still not going to get the justice we've been looking for Elsie. It feels like something has been taken away." Pickering was 80 years old. And believe me, we had questioned what would happen if he just died. When the police rang me this morning, I just kind of lost it. I think there will be some angry, upset, and annoyed people in Wakefield who have completely supported us. It will be difficult for them too. Peter Pickering's death meant that he would never be convicted of Elsie Frost's murder. So Elsie's siblings resigned themselves to a different type of justice. Anne and Colin lobbied the Attorney General for a new inquest into their sister's death to allow the police to publicly share the evidence linking Pickering to her murder. They crowdfunded the request and stated that it was important to them to posthumously exonerate Ian Spencer, who lived the rest of his life with the shadow of persecution hanging over him. Colin said, "He was an innocent man, and always was innocent, and he had an awful legacy to live through his life. We can't do anything for Mr. Spencer, but we can do something for his remaining family."
"We're just looking for the truth. If we can get the truth, we'll get the justice. And if we get the justice, we'll get some element of closure."
"There's a certain bitterness in our feelings that if the case had gone properly in the 1960s, maybe Shirley Ann Baldy would still be alive.
Yeah.
And a kidnap and rape that he committed a few weeks before Shirley Ann was murdered would not have happened either. So there's a lot of wrongs to be righted. And we're doing what we can to assuage all these errors that have happened over the years."
Elsie's older sister Anne expressed her dismay over the decision to try Pickering for the 1972 rape before charging him with Elsie's murder. She said, What that did, in effect, was it meant that it sidelined ours completely. It isn't just. The Crown Prosecution Service spokeswoman provided a response. Our deepest sympathies go to the Frost family. Although we understand the sense of frustration, it is not correct to say that other charges were prioritised above Elsie's murder. Investigations into all potential offences were carried out simultaneously, and the CPS provided ongoing advice from the earliest stages. The CPS did not receive a full file of evidence for Elsie's murder suitable for review until the 30th of January 2018, around 6 weeks before the suspect's death. In December 2018, Attorney General Geoffrey Cox QC MP consented to Elsie's family applying for a new inquest. Cox stated, "I am satisfied that there is new evidence available that was not put before the previous inquest, and I believe that it is in the interests of justice for the application for a new inquest to be heard by the High Court." Colin and Anne were apprehensive about the High Court's decision, as it was their last chance to get any semblance of closure. Colin remarked, "If the judges rule no, then there is no way forward, and the decision is out of our hands. If that is the decision, there will be no justice for Elsie, and her killer will have got away with the perfect murder. This could technically be the last chance for us to find out what happened to Elsie. All along, we have been fighting for justice for Elsie, who was brutally and needlessly murdered. Her life was taken away from her family and friends." In April 2019, the High Court approved the request. Lord Justice Irwin and Mr. Justice Jay ruled, "The existence of fresh evidence obtained by West Yorkshire Police into the circumstances of Elsie's death means that it is necessary or desirable in the interests of justice that the public record should accurately reflect what is known about the facts of her death." The new inquest was scheduled for November of that year. So where are we now? The inquest began at Wakefield Coroner's Court on November 18, 2019, before Senior Coroner Kevin McLaughlin. Detective Chief Superintendent Nick Wallen, who took over the reinvestigation and had since been promoted, said that Peter Pickering's name had come up in the original inquiry within days of Elsie's murder. Scotland Yard had sent a file on Pickering to the Wakefield investigators, but they were unable to locate him and requested the Metropolitan Police inform them if he was found. The court heard that Pickering's home in Wamwell had been under surveillance, and a person seen entering the property was mistaken for a woman, when in fact it was Pickering wearing women's clothing. Pickering was being investigated at the time for violent sexual assaults on two teenage girls, but his then-girlfriend had provided him with an alibi at the time of the crimes. She later recanted the alibi, and Pickering was apprehended, but by that point, Ian Spencer was named as a suspect. During the case review in 2015, staff at the hospital where Pickering was held since he was convicted of killing Shirley Baldy in 1972 contacted the police to tell them that he had implicated himself in Elsie Frost's murder. When Pickering was informed that West Yorkshire Police wanted to speak with him, he called them from the hospital and said that he had been in France at the time of the killing. Following the death of Pickering's mother in the mid-80s, he used his inheritance to buy a number of storage units in Sheffield and Liverpool. After obtaining search warrants to examine the units 3 decades later, investigators found documents and letters Pickering had authored, including one written days before Elsie was killed, in which he told his girlfriend, You have caused me to do what I'm about to do. You watch what happens next. I will surely go down in flames this time. I shall have to take someone with me when I go. So now what? To join the devil. Now I'm really going to get good and bloody nasty thanks to you. Pickering had also written to his mother instructing her to get their doctor to sign a false affidavit that he was in bed with the flu at the time of Elsie's murder. Pickering was interviewed by the police after his arrest in 2016, but denied any involvement in the crime. DCS Wallen said that even after Ian Spencer was acquitted, the police did not pursue Pickering as a suspect. The detective told the inquest, "Peter Pickering, in my view, is a homicidal maniac. I'm absolutely convinced that he killed her." In 2016, DCS Wallen told Ian Spencer that he would not have been charged with Elsie's murder in a modern investigation, but the coroner added that as Ian Spencer was suffering from dementia at the time of the conversation, he might not have understood its importance in exonerating him. DCS Wallen later spoke about a conversation he had with the Spencer family, including Ian's son, Lee. "The way it appears to me is that in 1965, the police investigation team became almost transfixed upon Ian Bernard Spencer, Lee's father. They built a case around him, and when that case fell apart, they took the view that they had got their man and that they had produced sufficient evidence to convict him. They simply drew up their stumps and retreated, and no further investigation took place. I have to say that things are so different in 2019. It simply would not happen today. But I think it is an interesting but tragic visit back to 1965. Ian Spencer had died in 2018. His son Lee testified at the inquest that his father made a point of creating a log of his movements to be able to prove his whereabouts in the future. The coroner added, "We have heard evidence from his son that on occasions police came to Mr. Spencer's home to check on his whereabouts when crimes were committed. He was 32 and lived the remainder of his life in the shadow of suspicion." Elsie Frost's older sister Anne spoke about the effect Elsie's murder had on her family. "My father completely went into a shell. He wouldn't talk about Elsie at all. My mother wanted to talk about her, and the only time she could talk about Elsie was with me. Dad was pretty much destroyed by what happened. There are no words to describe the effect it had on me. We were very close as sisters. We were both great readers because Dad encouraged that. He would take us both to the library together. We had similar interests in books, film, and music." Coroner Kevin McLaughlin recorded a verdict of unlawful killing, and although he was not allowed to apportion criminal liability on anyone, he said, "Mr. Pickering, it seems, was absorbed by Elsie Frost's murder. He has been exposed as a devious man. The picture that emerges is that Mr. Pickering was a dangerous man as far as young women were concerned." In an effort to console Elsie's family, the coroner went on to say, "Mr. Pickering has spent over 40 years in custody. He served a life sentence, literally. Mr. Colin Frost said he had got away with murder, but considering he spent the best part of his adult life in custody, it seems to me that Pickering did not get away with much." Anne and Colin were interviewed outside Wakefield Coroner's Court. They voiced their frustrations with the outcome, but acknowledged at least that they had cleared Ian Spencer's name.
We set out to do two things. We've always set out to get justice for Elsie.
and we set out to get Mr. Spencer's name cleared. We've achieved one out of the two. And as Anne says, you know, we just can't get the ultimate justice for Elsie. We've got as good as we can get today. We're grateful to the coroner for actually naming Peter Pickering and his summing up.
It's been a roller coaster, certainly for both of us. A lot of ups and some pretty serious downs at times as well.
Referring to the crimes Pickering went on to commit after Elsie's murder, including the rape of an 18-year-old and the killing of 14-year-old Shirley Baldy, Elsie's sister Anne concluded, "If things had gone as they should have done in 1965, those events may not have happened, and maybe then my sister's case could have come to full fruition." Thank you for listening. A special thanks to our new Patreon producer, Natalie, and all our patrons for their support. For more information on this episode, please see the show notes or visit our website, theywalkamonguspodcast.com.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Flimsy stands slowing you down? Well, it's time to upgrade. Armadillo builds durable, North American-made tablet stands and kiosks. We're so confident, we offer a lifetime warranty. So, elevate your business and visit armadillo.com. That's armodillo.com and use code ACAST for 5% off. Armadillo. Built to last. Designed to impress.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.